From Maine to Utah, North Dakota to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the potential implosion of Chinese real estate giant Evergrande roiled equity markets worldwide. Why such a big impact? Weifeng Zhang from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with the answer. It's fiscal crunch time under the Capitol Dome in Washington, and Democrats are feuding with each other. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. State legislatures across the nation are now working to put limits on the power of their governors after excess use of emergency declarations during the COVID-19 pandemic. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Daniel Dew of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And Congress is considering a proposal to add 87,000 new Internal Revenue Service agents and give them the power to access virtually every personal bank account. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It was a roller coaster week for equity markets worldwide as financial troubles at Chinese real estate giant Evergrande exploded on the financial scene. Here to talk about why the potential default of the firm had such an impact is Weifeng Zhang. He is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Weifeng, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Weifeng, probably most of our listeners have never heard of the Chinese company Evergrande. Tell us a bit about this company. Why are they so important? What is it that they do in China?
This company is a private company, but it's really an arm of China's state apparatus in terms of developing real estate properties and lending. And so in China, I think the line really between the state sector and private sector these days is more blurred than it used to be, unlike at the beginning of the famous economic reform that started in late 1970s. At the beginning, we saw all these private companies that seemed quite separate from the state. But unlike this is not the case here, because in recent years, the line is more blurred. And so what's happening now is that this state property giant is on the verge of defaulting because of all these debt problems. And in fact, that reflects to a large extent of the Chinese economy, because the Chinese economy has been in debt for quite some time, especially in the local level. And so what we are seeing now is what some people would consider the Lehman Brothers moment for China. I think it might be a little too early to call it that, but it will be very interesting to watch how it unfolds and whether the Chinese government would step in to bail out the company.
What has been the recent history of the Chinese government when companies get in trouble? Have they normally stepped in with a bailout, or would that be an extraordinary measure?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So one way we can gauge that is to look back at the most recent episode of stock market fallout like this, which is 2015. And so the Chinese stock market had a similar episode in 2015, which to some extent affected the rest of the global markets too. And what we saw back then was that oftentimes when we see troubles like this, we see some small scales of protests among Chinese people against all these economic problems. And we see this time too. Some investors and employees of this company, Evergrande, they came out and protest and saying that, you know, the company owes us money and we want the payback. And what the Chinese government's response typically is that if the protests sort of spread a little further, it creates a political uncertainty for the Chinese government. And that sometimes or oftentimes will motivate the government to step in. And so people protest about environmental, you know, polluting companies selling up in near their backyard, or real estate bubbles. Stock markets sometimes would reflect that too. And so what we saw in 2015 was the government quite swiftly later on, they step in and initiated a large-scale bailout. And so I think what we need to watch for this time is, do we see some burgeoning protests around this event here, which is, I think, in the last week is already coming up, it's on the rise. And so over the next few weeks, I think it will be important to monitor how much political pressure the regular folks in China are imposing on the authorities to come to step in. And it might actually happen, in my view. And so the Chinese economy might actually get over this, just like it did back in 2015.
This past week, the markets worldwide, and particularly here in the United States, were roiled. We had earlier in the week a major plummet in all of the major stock indices here in the United States. So the reverberations of this appear to be worldwide. Why is it that the potential default of a Chinese housing company is having such an impact on the American markets?
Well, I think the stake is quite high here because if you compare it to Lehman Brothers, the size is half as big. So this time, this Chinese company is half as big as Lehman Brothers, too. And so the default, half of that scale of 2007-2008, is quite impactful already. And not to mention that the Chinese economy now is much more intertwined with the rest of the global economy. And so this would, if really it forced apart, it would certainly send a shockwave to the rest of the global market, so which is understandable.
Shifting gears here a bit, Wei Feng, another major story involving China over the last couple of weeks was a deal that was reached, a strategic alliance between the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia to build nuclear submarines that would be sold to Australia. What is the strategic importance of this move to the United States?
I think that's a huge deal. People focus a lot more on the U.S. battling with France because of the fallout. Because the deal basically involved Australia reneging on the diesel-powered submarine deal with France so that Australia could buy nuclear submarines from the U.S. and probably in collaboration with the U.K. So the spending of the French caught a lot of attention in media. But what really I think is key here is that the empowering Australia with nuclear submarine would go a long way in terms of countering China's growing influence in the area, in particular in South China Sea, possibly also in Taiwan Strait as well. And the thing about nuclear submarine is that it allows the country to basically park the submarine off the coast, for example, of China and stay there for months without being detected. And that has a lot of value in terms of surveillance. And not to mention that some nuclear submarines could have nuclear attack power, which is way more threatening than diesel-powered submarines. And so in terms of the substance of the policy, I think it goes a long way in terms of countering China. The problem is just that execution of the policy, just like what we saw in Afghanistan, and pulling out eventually, I think, is a good idea. But pulling out in this particular way is very troubling. And so the same as the deal here is that I think executing the deal in this way, not telling the French government, and hurting our alliance with our oldest ally, I think it's problematic in terms of execution. But the deal itself, I think, makes sense.
We have been talking with Wei Feng Yang, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, and that's at George Mason University. Wei Feng, tell us a little bit about Mercatus Center, what it is you do, and where can folks go to read more about you?
The Mercatus Center is a research center based in George Mason University. And scholars like me at Mercatus, our job is to do economic research and bridge the gap between academic ideas and all these practical important real-world problems. And to learn more about our work, the best way is to go to mercatus.org.
Wei Feng Yang, who is, again, a senior research fellow at Mercatus Center. Wei Feng, thank you again for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Loma. My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. A lot of activity in Congress. Democrats don't have their act together, but we have reconciliation, we have a debt limit, we have a budget, all sorts of fiscal issues perking there. To sort it out, Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Can you make some sense for us out of all of that?
Yeah, well, you know, the way I would kind of look at it is let's think that there's baseball, basketball, and football championships, right? At the end of the year, we always have that Christmas tree omnibus appropriations. I think we're going to have that again this year. Let's call that the Super Bowl. And then at the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, let's say that we've got what we would call the World Series. And so we're embarking upon the World Series right now on Capitol Hill with a bunch of must-pass legislation percolating in the House and Senate, things that are critical to Joe Biden's agenda. and also to funding the U.S. government. So this week we saw the House of Representatives pass a debt limit suspension and also a continuing resolution. The debt limit would have been suspended through December of 2022, setting up another Christmas deadline. And the continuing resolution would have gone to, I think, December 2nd of 2021, which also sets up some fireworks for December. In the interim, the Senate still has not determined exactly how they're going to adjudicate that. And so the bill is sort of stalled, but we would expect action to be happening within those two items, certainly by September 30th. You've got Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell threatening to withhold all Republican votes for a debt limit suspension. And so far, he's held to his guns. We'll see exactly how that shakes out over the next several days. But it's a big, big, important thing when it comes to the fiscal health of the nation, whether or not the government shuts down. It's a partial government shutdown. Still, essential activities continue. And whether or not our debt obligations are paid through additional borrowing at Treasury. In addition to that, we've got all these big things going on with the infrastructure negotiations with that bipartisan infrastructure package that passed the Senate with 19 Senate Republicans, and also with the major, massive reconciliation package that we've talked about previously, a $3.5 trillion package.
Taking a look at this proposed massive spending, Scott, that Democrats are attempting to push through Congress, talk a little bit about the dysfunction within the Democrat conference. They can't quite seem to all get on the same page at this point.
Yeah, and you know, we have a 50-50 Senate, so if one senator peels off on reconciliation, the bill can die. But right now, all the action is in the House of Representatives, because the House of Representatives still hasn't passed that bipartisan infrastructure package that so many of the moderate Blue Dog, Mod Squad, Josh Gottheimer type Democrats want to see enacted prior to accommodating a reconciliation bill. And so on Monday, September 27th, is the deadline where Pelosi agreed to hold a vote for final passage in the House on that bipartisan infrastructure package. The problem is you've got all these progressives that don't want to deal with the moderates, and they're saying they're not going to vote for passage of that initial bipartisan bill unless they got reconciliation through first. And so you've got a little bit of leverage because, number one, the reconciliation bill is not ready. And Joe Biden this week actually held meetings with the moderates, with the progressives, with the House Democratic leadership and Senate Democratic leadership, and tried to come to a resolution in terms of what the top line numbers would be for reconciliation, and they can't even figure that part out. Now, the instructions themselves, meaning the budget resolution's authorization, allows for as much as $3.5 trillion to be spent on reconciliation for these radical investments and, you know, things that they think are infrastructure, whether it's, you know, your feelings or your love. You know, I'm kind of making a joke there, but they're not the traditional infrastructure things like roads and bridges and airports. They're extending it all the way down the line in terms of policies, part of the Green New Deal that they want to see enacted on reconciliation. So additionally, you've got some of the moderates to say, hey, you know what we should actually do? We should pay for this. Can you believe it? We should pay for what we're saying we're going to spend money on. And the way that they want to pay for it is massive tax increases. And so right now the Democrats are negotiating what the top line will be, and they're trying to determine that through how much revenue they think they can raise. How high can they raise the corporate rate? What do they do with capital gains? There's a number of other tax increases within the Biden agenda, including increasing the top rate on individuals, that are all on the table.
President Biden, Scott, by any measure, is a weak president. He's been just overwhelmed with problems from the botched withdrawal in Afghanistan, the crisis at the border, inflation, the COVID-19 pandemic once again resurgent. All of these things have weakened him. Does that then weaken his ability to put leverage and pressure on members of Congress to get together behind a specific bill?
I think it's a good question, and it's one that we're going to find out in the next few days. The bottom line is that there's a lot of members of Congress that they just get starstruck when they're in the Oval Office, when they're in the West Wing, when they're actually a part of the negotiations, and they want to find a way to accommodate the leader of their party. But I think you're right to point out the fact that Joe Biden is incredibly weak. He's a drag on the ticket. We were talking about governor's races earlier offline, and in Virginia, we've got an off-year election with Glenn Youngkin against Terry McAuliffe, and Glenn Youngkin over the last month since Afghanistan has completely flipped that race upside down and appears to be leading right now. So we got to see exactly what the political vulnerabilities are for Joe Biden when it comes to House Democrats and Senate Democrats, but it is definitely a concern, I think, for many of the Democrats that Joe Biden has lost a lot of the political leverage that he would normally have in the first year of a presidency.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, give us a few words about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Putting limits on the future use of emergency powers by governors is gaining steam in states across the nation. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Daniel Dew from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
When the COVID-19 pandemic struck last year, governors all over the country issued emergency orders that gave themselves massive powers over hospitals, private businesses, even churches in some cases. And now, 18 months after the pandemic began, those emergency orders are raising some interesting and difficult questions about just how far gubernatorial unilateral power should go in an emergency, and at what point do you have to bring the legislature, bring the democratic process into the policymaking sphere. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Daniel Dew. He is the legal policy director at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He's been following these emergency orders and the kind of emerging debate in state capitals over just how far those governor's powers should go. And he joins us now on the phone to talk about that. Daniel, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go back and start with the beginning of the pandemic, Dan, where we had emergency orders issued in, I think, just about every state. Governors, to varying degrees, shutting down schools, businesses, things like that. At some point, though, we reached a phase where the pandemic was just sort of a state of life rather than being sort of an acute emergency.
Yeah, at the very beginning, I think that emergency orders were probably warranted. We didn't know much about the virus or how transmittable it was, how lethal it was. And so the governors issued these emergency orders telling us to stay home 10 days to flatten the curve. But then once we got into months and months and months and over a year, the legislature really needed to step in and make law. That's the duty of the legislature, is to make law. And the governors just really took it too far. I mean, think about all the things that went on. We had at some point in 2020, 316 million Americans were told to stay home unless it was for a government authorized purposes. We had businesses and employees even classified as essential and non-essential. And a lot of times those distinctions were made arbitrarily. Governors were telling people which kind of health care they could receive, not based on what they decided with their doctor, but just based off of the governor decided whether it was vital or not. I mean, people missed cancer screenings and other health care things. And so I think that you can point to just about any of the governors and say that they really overstepped their boundaries. And then not only did they do that in the short term, but then they took it on for we're in 18 months now, and you still have some governors who are wielding emergency powers.
Part of the problem here seems to be that these emergency power statutes are just too broad to begin with, right? And I mean, I guess they're sort of written with the idea in mind of, oh, we have a bad blizzard or we have a flood, natural disaster, something like that, which is a thing that exists over a short period of time. Eventually the floodwaters recede, the snow melts, whatever. But that's not, when you actually look at these statutes, in many cases, they're not limited in any significant way, right? I mean, they do actually allow the governor to kind of do whatever he or she wants.
Exactly. Yeah, these laws were, like you mentioned, these things were meant to give the governor the flexibility to move power, to make temporary rules in order to save life or property. It wasn't really meant for them to make policy for the state. And so, yeah, what we saw is a lot of just going over the top. But the statutes in a lot of places actually allowed it. So, for example, in a few states, I think of Arizona, for example, it basically says that the governor has the police power of the state when an emergency is declared. And police power is the legalese for basically saying that any power that the state has, the governor then has while there's a declared emergency.
We're talking with Daniel Dew. He's legal policy director at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Daniel, you've been involved in some efforts at reforming some of these emergency power statutes in a number of states. I think Kentucky in particular, but a few others as well. Tell us a little bit about what you're advising state lawmakers to do, and maybe even just more generally, where you think those boundaries should be drawn if state lawmakers are interested in post-COVID going in and saying, well, no, you know, the next time there's a big emergency, we're not going to let this go on for 2 years.
Sure. I mean, our liberties are derived from the separation of powers. Yes, we have this great Bill of Rights, but it's not enforceable. It's a worthless document unless you have somebody enforcing it. And so what we're really trying to do is get each branch of government to do its constitutionally designated duty, even in times of crisis. So yes, there needs to be some flexibility for the governors at the beginning when a problem initially emerges, right? An emergency, it emerges. But once the dust has settled a little bit, then the legislature needs to step up and set policy for the state. The courts need to step in, and they need to articulate what the laws are and ensure that the government doesn't infringe on constitutional rights. So some of the things that we've recommended are placing time limits on emergency orders. So any emergency order lasting longer than 30 days, the legislature should have to come in and ratify that. The courts should step in and they should apply what's known as strict scrutiny to emergency orders that infringe on constitutional rights. So they really look at it closely and make sure that the orders aren't arbitrary, that they're narrowly tailored, that there's a compelling public health or safety issue. So those are the kind of things that we're really looking at helping state legislatures do so that all three branches of government function the way that they're supposed to.
The democratic process should still matter even in an emergency. Daniel Dew from the Pacific Legal Foundation, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, that is Daniel Dew. He is the legal policy director over at PLF, the Pacific Legal Foundation. You can check out their work online at pacificlegal.org. Check out everything that we're following with the pandemic at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Historic tax increases and a dramatically expanded Internal Revenue Service to collect them is under consideration in Congress. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Greetings from the land of make-believe here in Washington, D.C., where unprecedented attempts are underway to remake America with countless dangerous policy ideas being discussed even as I speak. Didn't we all collectively learn an important lesson from the mistakes of Obamacare a decade ago, where infamously Speaker Nancy Pelosi told members of Congress they had to pass the bill to know what's in it? Why wait until the last minute to release the legislative language and attempt to avoid public hearings in the United States Senate? Perhaps it's that public polling is clear and devastating for the big government advocates here in Washington. As former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich recently outlined, Americans are in general favor free market capitalism over big government socialism by a huge margin, 59% to 16%. Among swing voters, there's an almost 5-to-1 advantage for free market capitalism, 82% to 18%. Let's review some of the big ideas being discussed here in Washington today. The Joint Committee on Taxation estimates the current reconciliation proposal being talked about in the news would increase taxes on hardworking American taxpayers by a whopping $2 trillion. To unpack that a little, the proposals include increasing the top individual income tax from 37% up to 39.6%, which of course is paid by all the hardworking small business owners across the country, not just those millionaires and billionaires often talked about in the news. It would also raise our capital gains tax rate from 20% up to 25%. It would increase corporate income taxes from 21% up to 26.5%. Not only would this be higher than Communist China's 25% corporate income tax rate, but it also give the United States an average corporate income tax when combined with state-level taxes of over 30%. That would be the third highest corporate rate in the industrial world, behind just Colombia and Portugal. As we've learned from decades of economic research, higher income taxes inhibit economic growth more than any other type of tax increase. Some of the additional proposals being talked about include things like increasing death taxes on American families, increasing federal taxes on tobacco, and even those that wanted to quit tobacco and start vaping. Proposals being discussed may harm American energy independence by targeting the natural gas industry and its consumers, adding an estimated $242 in new costs annually to the energy bills of the average American. Ideas being discussed would also increase the Internal Revenue Service budget by $80 billion and to hire 87,000 new IRS agents over the next 10 years. In addition to this IRS expansion, the Biden administration has supported allowing the IRS to monitor transactions going into and out of personal and business bank accounts whose value or transactions exceed only $600. As my friend Patrick Gleason reported in Forbes this week, a resolution was filed in the Maine House of Representatives that would address this massive expansion in government surveillance, which would involve the majority of active bank accounts across the country. The resolution filed by Maine State Representative John Andrews points out that, quote, President Joe Biden wants the IRS to have automatic access to information about every American's bank account, as well as every PayPal, Venmo, and Cash App account, even if without any accusations of wrongdoing. This is unprecedented federal intrusion into the financial lives of everyday Americans. As state legislators, Representative Andrews said, it is our duty to stand up and be proactive and protect those we represent. This expansion of IRS power has faced backlash throughout the country. 23 state treasurers, auditors, as members of the State Financial Officers Foundation, a nonpartisan group, openly expressed their concerns with this proposal. They pointed out that it would affect more than 100 million Americans. Beyond the IRS, there is more unfairness proposed, such as increasing the electric vehicle tax credits to $12,500, which includes an additional $4,500 for electric vehicles built in union shops. America Honda Motor Company commented that this unfair proposal, quote, discriminates among electric vehicles made by hardworking American auto workers simply based on whether they belong to a union. The Honda production associates in Alabama, Indiana, and Ohio who will build our electric vehicles deserve fair and equal treatment by Congress. Finally, proposals that would expand the federal Medicaid program in 12 states have rejected Obamacare's expansion. As Brian Blaze noted in the Wall Street Journal this week, the proposal would give the Health and Human Services Secretary the ability to run a federal Medicaid expansion over state objections starting in 2025. Before then, the feds would send subsidies directly to health insurers to cover this population in the Affordable Care Act exchange plans. This is a huge transfer of taxpayer dollars to the health insurers. And moreover, this is an incredibly dangerous threat to state autonomy and the principle of federalism. Unfortunately, Washington is indeed the land of make-believe economics today, with the trillions in new taxes and spending that would make Americans poorer and make America less competitive abroad. For more information, visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas. Welcome to our new listeners in the Lone Star State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.